is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, May 14th, 2020. Taylor Schwenk is producing from his home studio in Connecticut. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. Today, as we continue Broadcaster Week, there's no more famous broadcaster in sports than Charles Barkley, the Hall of Famer, TNT basketball analyst, is a huge baseball fan. And as it turns out, he shared a COVID-19 concern this spring with the best player in baseball, Mike Trout. He'll share that story and a lot more, including his opinion on the toughest thing to do in sports. We'll also be talking with our Kylie McDaniel, who tells us who's likely to land in the top of the draft and whether he thinks there's going to be rampant cheating. First, I really appreciated this yesterday. Matt Carpenter, the Cardinal, sent out on Twitter, "I miss rain delays. I miss getting jammed in cold weather. I miss batting gloves. I miss long replay reviews that don't get overturned, even though he was safe. I miss umpires. I miss long flights at 3 a.m. after a tough loss. I miss the shift. I do. I miss it all." The Miami Marlins will temporarily furlough 90 to 100 baseball operations employees beginning June 1st because of the coronavirus pandemic. According to multiple reports, about 40% of the baseball operations staff will be affected, with the status of those furloughed to be evaluated monthly. Their health benefits will continue through the end of October. A lot of attention on what Blake Snell said yesterday in a live stream session on Twitch. Give a listen.
No, I'm not splitting no revenue. I want all mine. Bro, y'all gotta understand too, because y'all gonna be like, "Bro, Blake, play for the love of the game, man. What's wrong with you, bro? Money should not be a thing." Bro, I'm risking my life. What do you mean it should not be a thing? It 100% should be a thing. If I'm gonna play, I should be getting the money I signed to be getting paid. I should not be getting half of what I'm getting paid because the season's cut in half, on top of a 33% cut of the half that's already there. So I'm really getting like 25%. On top of that, it's getting taxed. So imagine how much I'm actually making to play. You know what I'm saying? Like, I ain't making shit. And on top of that, so all that money's gone. And now I play risking my life. And if I get the Rona, on top of that, if I get the Rona, guess what happens with that? Oh, yeah, that's in my body forever. That damage is not going to be like, the damage that was done to my body, that's going to be there forever. So now I got to play with that on top of that. So y'all got to understand, man, for me to take a pay cut is not happening, because the risk is through the roof. It's a shorter season, less pay. Like, bro, it's, yeah, man, I got to get my money. I'm not playing unless I get mine, okay? And that's just the way it is for me. Like, I'm sorry if you guys think differently, but the risk is way the hell higher and the amount of money I'm making is way lower. Why would I think about doing that? Like, you know, I'm sorry. So in my head, I'm preparing for next season.
So Taylor, the producer on the show, is always sort of the voice of the fan. And when you heard all that, what'd you think?
Interesting media strategy for Blake Snell there, trying, as he's part of one side of these discussions, you know, with all this going on, these players kind of popping their heads up and saying whatever on their mind and then hopping back down in their holes. I find it fascinating that they just have this, they don't really have a plan as to what they're doing and their messaging, you know, and I know this isn't a regular labor dispute, but in years past, like when the NBA had, you know, labor disputes, it's Chris Paul with his team making statements, you know, it's not some random donk just spouting off on Twitch. And it's also pretty amazing that he's making this big statement while he's essentially mouthing off like while he's playing video games, like any other kid would, except he's a Major League Baseball player with some, you know, probably some, he has some say in these negotiations. And then the bigger thing is, you know, he wants all his money, but dude, if there's no baseball, there's no money. So I don't know what he's talking about. I mean, there has to be a compromise. So for him to come in hot and be like, "I'm not compromising, I want my money," like, where are you getting the money from if there's no games, bro? Where's it coming from? I don't understand. Pretty hot take from Blake Snell, but I think he should maybe just keep his mouth shut a little bit and leave it to the leadership with the Players Association.
We'll be talking about that with Kylie McDaniel, and we'll be speaking with Charles Barkley. As I mentioned, if you want more baseball content, fantasy-focused baseball is still rolling on. Eric and Tristan are discussing the latest 2020 season proposal, possible realignment, universal DH, and answering your questions. You can find those guys wherever you get your podcasts. Kylie McDaniel covers baseball for ESPN. And Kylie, look, we're going to talk about the draft. Your mock draft for the first round was posted on ESPN.com the other day. But we got to start with what Blake Snell said yesterday on Twitch, his comments. And when I heard them, it just made me shake my head. I understand, like, there is absolute truth in everything that he was talking about. There's legitimate concerns about safety that the players have to address. There's legitimate concern about where the negotiations are going to go. And I still do not understand why they are talking about this out loud. How did you feel when you heard that?
I mean, I can sympathize with it some because, like you're saying, there's truth in what he's saying, and I get where he's coming from. And also from the union's perspective, making every player toe the line is going to be real difficult when you got a bunch of millionaires in their 20s and 30s that are, you know, frustrated and want to get out there and all that kind of thing. So how do you, you know, you're going to get one leak if it's Blake Snell and we're going to hear about it. It's going to make everybody look bad. But like you're saying, there's so many parts of this that get negotiated in the media, and there's leaks, and then there's, you know, sort of bad PR stances and insensitive things. And this is just another example where, Manfred doesn't have any trouble keeping all of his owners in line. None of them have really stepped out and said things that he has trouble defending. They have a united front. They're all somewhat homogenous in what they want, and being able to sort of group them together and have one person speaking for them. And then with just the players and the agents and the union, it's not super clear who's in charge or if they're doing a good job. And they've got a bunch of different, you know, versions of wants and needs from these different areas of the union leadership. And it's just sort of a mess. And I was mentioning earlier that I did some radio the last few days, and the question from all these like local radio stations is, are we going to get an agreement? And the answer is, well, obviously, yes. Like, the stakes are too high to not get an agreement. But the question is how bad the PR is going to get between now and when the agreement happens.
And it damages the product. Not only does it hurt, specifically when stuff like that is said out loud, it just reflects a lack of self-awareness that there are people who are tens of millions of people have lost their jobs. They're wondering about their next mortgage payment. They're standing in food lines. And to say that out loud, that you can't come to an agreement over a chunk of money. It's just people are not going to relate to that. I remember during the 94-95 strike, there were some famous meetings. Tony Gwynn told me great stories about these, where there were players in the room who disagreed with the stance of the union. And basically, they were told by their peers, shut up. And you were not allowed to speak out loud about all that and your feelings on it as we go through this process, because we have to have a united front. Now, that is far more difficult to execute in 2020 because they have social media and every player, in theory, has their own platform. But still, I said the other day when we saw the statement from Tony Clark, the comments by Scott Boras, and now what Blake Snell is saying, I don't see how it helps any of them to talk out loud about this.
Yeah, and it's, I think even especially the fact of Blake Snell, it's like you're going to play, you know, up to half a season. You're going to play every fifth game. You're not even going to play the whole game. Like, the sort of lift on this in terms of, you know, your sacrifices, you're going to have to be in a bubble and be tested and still not even do like that much sort of on-field work, even relative to the other players, and a couple million's not enough for you. It's just sort of like, this is a season where, you know, the example I always use talking to like friends or, you know, around Atlanta is, I'm like, Freddie Freeman's going to lose, you know, $18-20 million and he's never going to get it back. Like, some people, even in sort of the Blake Snell area of like, you know, Cy Young and MVP type candidates, are losing way more money. And it has to go here. And unfortunately, it's the, you know, sometimes the view that people have of, you know, millennials and young people is they're, you know, ungrateful and entitled and complaining about stuff, no matter, even though they've had all these things provided for them. And Blake Snell just sort of falls right into that.
Oh, boy. Well, I hope it spurs a conversation on the player's side and coalesces into a collective feeling of, let's not talk out loud about this. Let's just negotiate behind closed doors and see where we go from there. All right. So I want to ask you about your mock draft. Give me the rundown of your top three picks.
So first overall, I have Spencer Torkelson, a first baseman from Arizona State, going to the Detroit Tigers. He's a, you know, roughly Pete Alonso type, right-handed hitting, big time power, some pretty good hitting ability. Seems like the consensus number one overall pick. And so that's sort of like a chalk expectation. Number two overall, I have Austin Martin, a multi-positional infielder, outfielder from Vanderbilt, going second. His best position is probably second base. Some teams will say third, some will say center. It's big time hitter, great plate discipline, emerging power, has some throwing issues, which is why I think second base or center field will be the fit. That's the Baltimore at number two. And then third to the Marlins, I have Asa Lacy, the lefty out of Texas A&M. The delivery and the command come and go a little bit. His finish is a little bit awkward, but it's mid-90s stuff, high 80s slider, changeup that's above average at times, the fastball slider are plus to plus-plus. So he's, you know, potential frontline guy. And then the one sort of, issue I explore is that, because those top two players are advised by Scott Boras and Asa Lacy, the third one is not. Asa Lacy also fits what Detroit at number one typically has drafted in the past. There's a chance he could price himself in such a way to be a cut rate number one option to save money for other picks. Depending on sort of how the prices and all that goes, because those three are seen as sort of the top three prospects, even though Torkelson is seen as being a little bit ahead of those other two.
The fact that this draft is going to be only five rounds, how is that shaping some of the strategy that you've heard teams are going to use?
A bunch of different ways. I think it varies from team to team. The sort of overriding things are, without a full spring, teams are going to go towards the players that they have a lot of track record with and a lot of data. That's going to be a lot of college players. They also would like to sort of cut on slot amounts in the first couple rounds to save money for later. Because the high school players teams might want for $1 or $2 million, because they didn't have a spring, they might not be consensus guys. You don't have to take them in the first or second round. You can take them later and pay them that first or second round money. So to me, that means once you get past those handful, six or eight high school players that everybody agrees on, they'll probably go in the same spots. But signable college guys with track record will get pushed up in those first two rounds. And then some harder sign high school players will go in the third or fourth round. And then everyone's going to use that fifth round pick to save money, because the gap between the most you can get as an undrafted free agent and what you're supposed to get as a fifth round pick is about a $300,000 gap. And so everyone's going to say, hey, do you want $20,000 or do you want $350,000? We're going to offer you $100,000. We can save that $200,000 to go spend on somebody else in the other rounds. And then also the margin for error in teams. You know, there's a lot of teams like the Braves last year who like cut on 10 or 12 picks and then sign an extra five or six high school players late. You don't have enough picks to do that now. So the margin for error in terms of if you get a couple duds up top, you don't have enough picks or enough money to make up for that. And so, again, it goes back to sort of safety and saving money and trying to spread out that risk as far as you can.
I've spoken with club officials who believe there are going to be teams that are going to try to abuse the system, to break the rules, to, because of the cap spending on players after the fifth round, $20,000, they feel like that there will be teams that will be funneling the tractor to Uncle Fred out in Iowa, or maybe money to an offshore. It's going to be like the NCAA, in other words, in trying to draw best players. What have you heard along those lines?
So I've heard things on both ends of the spectrum. So there's, you know, we saw the report yesterday that the Marlins are expected to lay off a bunch of employees, which is terrible news. But you know, Jeff and I had heard rumblings of teams that are in some financial trouble that they may not even spend their entire bonus pool and may just like cut, you know, 10-20% on every pick. And so that's, you know, one small part of the industry. The other part of it is I've heard some teams saying, oh yeah, we can really compete for these $20,000 free agents because we have a better player development system. And so as a player, your value will increase more with us than well with another team that's not quite as good. And teams that, you know, have very strong farm systems, I think are already jockeying for position for who can sign the most $20,000 free agents. I've also heard some teams that have already said, we don't have enough money margin for error wise, if it turns out there's zero big league games this year, to sign any free agents. And then at the other end, I mentioned an article yesterday about strategies in the draft. The conditions may be the best if you have the cash flow to blow it out and spend $50 million in this draft and take the two first round pick penalty along with some bonus penalty payments, because no one else is going to be doing it. And it's easier than ever to move high school players around. And so I kind of lay out the conditions for that in my article. But along the same lines as what you're saying, some teams are choosing to pay their minor league players more. There could be a move from teams to just change the policy, because MLB has said that they're going to keep an eye on teams figuring out a way, as you're saying, to you know, funnel more money to players as a way to entice them to sign. If you choose to pay all of your minor league players more, that's just something that's going to be part of the contract you offer every free agent. That's not illegal under the rules. And again, if you've got the cash flow and you feel okay doing that, if you can get an extra 6 or 8 free agents you wouldn't normally be able to get to pay all of your minor leaguers a little bit more, that may actually be worth it. And you can always change that policy later.
And you and I talked about this a month, 5 weeks ago, about the tremendous fear of layoffs in the industry. You mentioned the Marlins and what their plans are. That there is an anticipation among people I talk to that that will especially be true among scouts. What have you heard?
Yes. So I don't want to mention any specific teams. Obviously, the Marlins, it's already been, sort of reported. They were one of the teams where it was rumored. In general, if you want to try to guess which teams I'm referring to, the ones that have very low revenues / payrolls, the ones that have been in money trouble, the ones that are near their payroll ceiling, the ones that have just built new stadiums and taken on a lot of debt, that's essentially all the teams that are rumored to be in trouble. And we've seen some actual signs from how the teams are behaving that indicate that that is the case. That's the sort of 6 or 8 teams that we keep hearing over and over are in some trouble. And it's not a coincidence that the league sort of settled on, we're going to pay people through May, which brings you into obviously, you know, the draft being the second week of June. We're going to wait until the draft, essentially. A, we're not going to need area scouts or a bunch of different scouts as much then. I mean, it's probably not going to be pro scouts at these pro games as they're happening. And also by then, teams will know, are we having spring training? Are we having games? They have a better idea of where their revenue is coming from. It just sort of made sense as like a date for the league to make decisions on these things, all 30 teams as a league. And the expectations are, at that point, you can justify, I mean, if you're talking about your A-ball trainers and coaches and your 15th area scout for an area that you can't see anybody for the next 6 months, like, as an owner that's trying to save money, it is easy to justify letting these people go. Obviously, we're rooting for that not to happen, but being realistic, it's going to happen. It's just a matter of how widespread it's going to be.
It's going to be tough. All right, Kylie, thanks for this. We'll talk to you soon.
Yep, thanks for having me on.
Charles Barkley played 16 years in the NBA, and now you see him as an analyst talking basketball on TNT. But I always heard, Charles, that you're a big fan of baseball. Thanks for joining us. I have to believe, because you are who you are, that you got opportunities where you were at a ballpark and somebody gave you a chance to step into the cage and take some swings.
Yeah, it turned out very badly, number one. Trying to catch fly balls was probably the worst part of it. You know, Buster, I became a baseball fan. Growing up in Alabama, my grandfather was the biggest Atlanta Braves fan in the world. And he grew up watching in the time for the Birmingham Black Barons, so he loved baseball. And we watched the Braves every weekend. What's the third baseman's name? Bob Horner, Dale Murphy, those guys. When I got a chance to meet Dale Murphy, I said, man, my grandfather was the biggest Atlanta Braves fan in the world. And that was my first affiliation with baseball. And then when I got drafted to the Philadelphia 76ers, and ever since then, man, I've been a Phillies fan, and I've got to know a majority of the guys well in the last 30 some years, going back to Nails and those guys. Darryl Dunn, rest in peace, was really one of the great guys I met when I was in Philadelphia, and obviously with the Ryan Howard and Jimmy Rollins guys for the last 20 some years, it's been a great ride. That's why I love baseball.
So tell me about you. You made reference at some point you got a chance to catch fly balls and step into a cage. I'm guessing that happens, and that happened in Philly.
It did, but it actually happened with the Chicago Cubs. One of my best friends, even to this day, is Rick Sutcliffe, and Rick has been friends with me for a long time. So when they came to Philly, Rick called me, and he says, "Hey, I need a place to play golf." I said, "I'll set it up." So I took Rick out to play golf. We had a wonderful time. And he took me down to the stadium. And I got in there and couldn't hit air. I could not hit air. And I shagged some fly balls, which was, there was two things that sucked for me about baseball. number one, when I was in the outfield, I thought I was going to catch the fly ball, and next thing I know, it's like 10 feet over my head. And I was like, man, this is a little harder than it looks. And I'm still playing at the time, so I got some talent. And then the thing that drove me crazy, Buster, I could hear the ball hit the mitt, and I'd swing at it. That's how amazing these guys' reflexes are. Like, I could hear it for a split second, and then I would swing. And, man, I just got admiration and respect for these guys.
So I covered for 4 years in San Diego, Tony Gwynn, when I worked at the San Diego Union Tribune, who played at San Diego State. He set the all-time assist records for the basketball team. They let him play baseball. He turned out to be pretty good at baseball. And I asked Tony once, what's the most difficult thing to do in sports? And he goes, hit. I mean, you're a tremendous athlete. What do you think is the most difficult thing to do in sports?
Oh, I think it's probably got to be to hit a pitch because, just thinking about it was really funny. I was watching that Michael Jordan documentary the other night, and I didn't realize he had a 13-game hitting streak to start the season. And then the coaches, I was wondering when they were going to stop throwing him fastballs, and then he didn't get another hit for like the next 2 months. So that to me tells me how difficult. Like, it's easy to hit a pitch that's coming straight, but curveballs and sliders and changeups and things like that, that's got to be the most difficult thing in sports to hit a pitch.
All right. You are a son of Alabama, famously. So is Henry Aaron, and so is Willie Mays. I'm guessing at some point in your lifetime you've gotten a chance to meet those guys.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've had the chance to meet both several times, but I don't. I get so nervous when I've been around those guys because, you know, you talk about royalty. There's no, to me, those two guys are the most, first of all, they're two of the nicest gentlemen you ever going to meet. And just being around, well, anytime I'm around Mr. Aaron, you are so humbled because, you know, you think about all the his grace and dignity with all the stuff that was going on when he was chasing Babe Ruth's record. And obviously, being from the South, I've read a bunch of stuff and heard a bunch of stuff. And he is the classiest man you're ever going to meet. And anytime I've been around him, I just get so nervous and just, it's kind of like I'm looking at a school girl back in high school. Like, you get all googly-eyed. Now, Mr. Mays is a little bit different because he is so energetic and outgoing. He's a little bit more outgoing than Mr. Aaron is. But being around those two guys, it's pretty surreal. Listen, when I'm around Bill Russell, that's the only thing that I can compare it to. Like, when I'm around Bill Russell, I'm like, wow, I cannot believe that I'm around Bill Russell. Kareem is a little bit different because, you know, I played against Kareem. But when I'm around Mr. Aaron and Mr. Mays, it's pretty surreal.
How was that? Can you describe the first time you met Henry Aaron?
It was at a function. And so, actually, one of my friends, it's his personal assistant. And we had been talking for years, and I'm like, I don't want to bother him. I don't want to bother him. And she said, I'm going to set up a meeting for you and Hank. And when I met him, I just said, this is one of the greatest days of my life. And, you know, one, I know the Alabama connection, but just being around guys from Alabama who were that great at their sport, I felt like it was one of the greatest days of my life, plain and simple.
I was 10 years old when he broke Babe Ruth's record, and my mom left me a note on the kitchen table, which I still remember. You know, Henry Aaron broke the record. The crowd cheered. That's my recollection of that moment. What do you remember? Because you were 11 years old.
I don't remember a lot about it. I don't want to be disingenuous. I learned more about it later when I started studying baseball. Like I say, my grandfather, he's the man, the reason I love baseball. And I go to probably 10 to 15 Phillies games a year right now, because I live, even though I live here in Scottsdale, I live in Philadelphia during the summer. So I'm a legitimate fan, and I want to know. And I got to tell you this funny story, Buster. So Mike Trout, who's the best baseball player today. So when I got tested for the coronavirus, they says, "Hey, the TNT called me and said, hey, Mike Trout want your number." Because I had just spoke to the Angels like about 10 days before. And I'm thinking, Mike Trout going to call and like I said, we'd met before. He's going to call and check on me and make sure I'm all right. And then he calls me. He's like, hey, Charles, I just want to check. Hey, did you get your test results back? I'm like, nah, man. They told me it's going to be a couple days. And the thing that was hilarious, he was calling to see did I have it because he wanted to make sure he didn't have it. And he calls me, and the thing is really funny. It took me like 10 days to get my results. So he was calling me like every other day, and I felt bad for him. I started feeling better like a day later, but I was so upset that Mike was quarantined waiting on my results, and I can laugh about it now. But he was calling me every other day to check on my results so he can feel like he didn't have the coronavirus. So I can laugh about it now, but it was not funny 6 days into my quarantine.
Man, so you must have been excited to call him to tell him when you tested negative then.
Hey, first person I called. Listen, how about this? First person I called was Mike Trout. Second person was Patrick Ewing, because when I had flown to New York to do Colbert, and Patrick had asked me to speak to his team before the Big East tournament. So I got Patrick Ewing and Mike Trout calling me every day. And number one, I laughed now, but they didn't give a shit about me not having the virus. They were worried about them or their players didn't have it. So I can laugh about it now.
Oh, man, you're not kidding. That would have been a heck of a complication.
I felt bad for Mike because I'm like, Mike, that was like 10 days ago that I spoke to your team. He said, well, they put us in quarantine until you get your results back. And Patrick, I said, dude, I feel better already. I was just worn down because I was in five states in like 5 days. He said, well, I got to tell my team. And like I say, I got on TNT. I said, y'all sent me to the worst damn hospital in the world because it took 10 days.
So in getting ready to interview you, I called Tim Kirkchin, who a couple of years ago, he got to meet you. He just raved about you, talked about what a big baseball fan you are. And I didn't know this. I didn't remember it, but you were at the game that Cal Ripken broke Lou Gehrig's consecutive game record in 1995.
No. No.
So Tim was wrong about that?
No, Tim was wrong. But let me tell you something. I've been giving Tim a lot of love on TV and radio the last week and a half because he had the best line I've ever heard a sportscaster use. And I said, I want to make sure that Tim Kirkchin gets this information, get credit for this comment. He said, as far as starting sports, he says, all these ideas are bad ideas. We're just going to have to take the best bad idea and start playing sports again. And I've been telling people, Tim Kirkchin, first of all, he's a hell of a basketball player, too. And I'm still trying to figure out why he's a hell of a basketball player, because I can't remember. I just don't remember what team he was going to be on.
Charles, I played basketball with Tim. He was a good player, and he also would have that incredible Hulk thing. When he would get pissed off at somebody, he would lose his mind. He was the only sports writer who Cal Ripken invited to his gym to play. That's how good Tim was.
Well, and I know all the brothers who are sportscasters, and they would say, we get together at different events, and they all want to play basketball. And they says, "Guys, you and I'm calling up Jay or Donde, Wilbon, and guys. They're like, guys, you, they said, Chuck, you're not gonna believe who, because I was excited to meet him because I had never met him before. So that was the thing I told him. I said, yo, man, I hear you a hell of a basketball player. And they told me, they said, man, Curtin is a hell of a player. And he just started laughing. He said, well, they're exaggerating a little bit. Trust me, they don't exaggerate. These are my friends. That you must be a hell of a player.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no chance that Cal Ripken invites him to his gym unless he can actually keep up with everybody in that game. My biggest regret, the time I was at Vanderbilt, it looked like Auburn and Bo Jackson were going to come in for a weekend series against the Vanderbilt baseball team, and that was the weekend where he decided, you know what, he's going pro, and so he never played in that series. Tell me about the first time you laid eyes on him.
The first time I met Bo Jackson was in high school. My high school team was ranked in the top five. And Bowden was ranked, I don't even know what Bowden was ranked. So we were a powerhouse. And the one thing that's weird about Bo Jackson didn't have any growth spurts. He was the same size in high school, college, pro, still today. Like, I grew from 5'10 to 6'5 in 1 year, and I came out of nowhere. Bo Jackson was his exact size in high school. So we went and played them, and we were our team was loaded. And this dude just went ballistic. It was a man playing against boys. And I'm like, wow, that was incredible what I just watched. I said, we got a good team, and this guy just ran up and down the field. It's kind of like if that documentary, what's the Dupree kid name from
Mississippi? Yeah, Marcus Dupree.
It was the exact same way for both. Like, every time he touches, like, there's a chance he could score every single time he touches. So then, okay, I go to college. The next year, Bo comes to campus. And I tell people, man, one of the greatest things of my life is for 2 years, I got an opportunity to watch Bo Jackson play every Saturday and then go watch him play baseball. It was incredible. It was incredible, and it was one of the greatest things in my life.
Now, as he was going through that choice, because you got to know him a little bit, as he was going through that choice about what he should do, what were you thinking? What were you kind of rooting for him to do? Me, as a baseball guy, I was hoping he would just stick with baseball.
I didn't want him to play baseball because I think he could have been the greatest running back ever. I just think that, number one, you never know about baseball. I mean, he had a couple of really good years, but this guy, I thought, could have been the greatest football player, running back ever. I mean, you talk about Jim Brown, you talk about guys like that. This guy was going to be on the Mount Rushmore of running backs because there's not a lot of guys who are looking to hit Bo Jackson. You know, because I met a bunch of great running backs. Like, I know Emmitt Smith really well. We play a lot of golf. I know Marcus Faulk really, really well. I play golf with Marcus Allen and Eric Dickerson. Them dudes ain't big as Bo Jackson. I mean, I play golf with all those guys consistently. And I know Bo Jackson. And when you see those guys and then you see Bo Jackson, there is like, yeah, it's not a lot of people want to tackle this dude. There's not a lot of tackling going on here. They're going for his legs. They're not trying to hit him up high.
Charles, what do you remember about that when Bo was playing with Seattle, with the Royals, and they were playing against the Mariners, and he threw out Harold Reynolds at home plate with that throw from the warning track in left field? Just you, what do you remember about seeing that for the first time?
You know, that play is so iconic. You're like, no, he didn't throw that ball on the fly like that. You know, that the night he played when he was playing for the Raiders when he ran over Brian Bosworth.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there are some plays. Those are two right at in different sports, obviously, where you're like, wow, nobody else can do that. And that's what I was saying going back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, Dave Parker had a gun. My man who played for Montreal, Vladimir Guerrero had a gun.
Oh, yeah.
There's some guys who got guns. But, like, there's not many – that's the reason I wanted Bo to play football. There's not many guys that big, that fast. I went and saw Bo in a track meet one time. I saw two guys in a track meet. They didn't run against each other. Bo Jackson and Herschel Walker. Well, they were 30 pounds probably bigger than both guys, than anybody else in the race. And the other guys looked like sprinters. And when those guys got going, I'm like, wow, to be that big and that strong and that fast, it's crazy. Like, when I saw Bo run and when I saw Herschel Walker run, I'm like, nobody should be that big and that fast. I mean, it's just incredible.
I've always wondered what you thought about baseball's culture. You know, when I covered the sport, when I've covered the sport, I always felt like the reason why that players didn't like bat flipping or you know, staring at the opposing pitcher or something like that is because there's so much failure in baseball that players are like act the same way every plate appearance.
It just comes down. It's like that in every sport. There's like rules. Listen, there's been times when I've been down 20 and I saw a guy shooting a three, and if one of my guys did not take him out, I was going to kick their ass after the game. I'm like, yo, man, we're down 20. We've proceeded the game. If anybody shoot a three, you take them out. But it's things like that in every sport. But I think the thing you got to, like, you do have to evolve. You do have to evolve, but there are certain things you can't do. I truly believe that. I think you have to evolve. There's some things that, okay, we're going to have to change the rules a little bit. But there are certain things that I'm never going to give in. Like I said, if a guy shoots a three up 20 on me, oh, I got to take him out. That's just part of it. But those are the rules. And I think most of the guys stick to them because, you know, the one thing you do notice about that, Buster, most of the good teams don't do stuff like that. It's most of the teams that are not used to winning who do things because, like, that's their only time to shine because they're not going to win, so you have to draw attention to yourself. Think about it. I don't think a lot of good teams show the other team up.
No, 100%. The best team I ever covered, the 98 Yankees, they won 125 games during the year, 114 in the regular season. And I had managers, players on other teams say that not only were they the best team, but they were so respected because they just played hard. And there wasn't a lot of that.
But also, they were used to winning.
Right.
Yeah. When you get used to winning, you're like, first of all, because when you win, you understand one thing. Damn, winning is hard. You know, that's the one thing I don't think people understand about any sport. Like, yo, man, it's hard to win. You know, you get you talk about, let's take Derek Jeter and guys like that. They won. Did they win 5 championships?
Yeah, he was involved in 5. They won 4 in 6 years, and then they won again in 2009.
But they probably played. He probably played 20 years, right?
Charles, he played 160 postseason games.
but the point I'm trying to make is, like, as great as Derek Jeter was, they only won 5 times out of 20 years. So when you start winning, you're like, man, it's hard to win. So the good teams, they don't do stupid stuff. Most of the guys who do stupid stuff, like, we suck, we don't have a good team, I got to bring attention to myself. Because winning is very difficult. And I think when you've been around, because you notice a lot of the young guys are the one who do stuff to get people pissed off. Because they're not in it. Because when you first get in, you're just excited to be in, no matter what sport it is. It takes you a while to get in, like, oh, we trying to win the championship. Like, when you first make it, you're like, damn, I made it to the show. I made it to the show. And then your first few years, you're learning how to win. So every time you do something, you're excited. But once you're in the game, you're like, man, winning is hard. And, like, you might play, like I say, I played for 16 years, But I probably only played on 8 really good teams. Where I'm saying, like, I probably only played on 5 teams that could actually win the championship. But I probably only played on 8 teams that were really good.
Yeah, 100%. Last one before you go, give me a baseball player that you really enjoyed watching among guys who are playing now.
Well, I'm biased because living in Philly during the summer, and you know, Mike Trout broke our heart when he signed with the Angels, because you know Bryce Harper had been talking for the last, you know, we're going to get Mike Trout. We're going to get Mike Trout. And then when he signed that lifetime deal with the Angels, like, no, we're not going to get Mike Trout. My favorite player today is Mad Max in D.C. I love that guy.
Yeah.
I love Scherzer. I do. I love Mad Max because one of my favorite hockey player is Ron Hextall. And I hope, when I was a player, I really mean this sincerely, if somebody was sitting in the stand, I wanted them to say, that guy wants to win. And when I learned about hockey, when I got to Philly, every time I watched Ron Hextall play, I was like, that guy wants to win. And I've been watching, even going back to Detroit, even before he came to the Nationals, when I watch Max Scherzer pitch, that dude want to win. That dude wants to win. So he's been my favorite baseball player. I was happy he finally got the World Series. So Max Scherzer is probably my favorite player today.
Oh, he's going to love that story. That's someone who on the morning of Game 5 of the World Series, he couldn't lift his arm. It didn't look like he was going to pitch, and then he winds up starting Game 7, and they win the World Series. I bet
you.
Yeah,
and like I say, I told Ernie a couple of years ago, I don't know if he told him, he was doing a Nationals game, and I said, hey, man, tell Scherzer he's my favorite player. I love that dude, man. I really do.
Oh, Charles, I could talk to you all day. I love hearing your stories, and as I told you before we got going, I love watching you play when we were both in the SEC.
Well, Buster, you do a fantastic job. I mean that sincerely, not just saying, well, like when you text me, I'm like, of course I'm going to do you, brother, because I got admiration and respect. And if I can ever do anything for you, man, let me know.
Well, I appreciate it, Charles. Great to talk with you.
All right, you take care of yourself. Hey, hope you all get to play soon.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. Chev Chielos at SpectreVision25 writes in, I know this pandemic has set things back, but what is the status of the Rays and A's new stadiums? I'd obviously love to see the Rays move to Nashville, which is a city dying to have a Major League Baseball franchise. We talked about this a little bit the other day, but what's your read on these two situations?
Boy, difficult. I mean, I would not want to be the baseball owner going to a local government and asking for public funding right now.
not going to happen.
I got to believe, and I haven't really dug that deeply into this, but I got to believe that as the dust settles, this is going to set back those efforts tremendously. So we'll see how it plays out.
Pony up, owners. All right, Reggie Deal at BaseballNerd07 writes in, Buster, with few rounds and limited NCAA roster spots, it seems like a lot of high school picks who might have signed will go to junior college. With scouting cuts, doesn't that make the 2021 draft a real crapshoot?
Reggie, a major league manager said that to me in conversation yesterday, exact thing that you touched on. He goes, man, you talk about the people who are going to clean up in the situation, the JUCOs. It's going to be like a great year for junior college baseball with all these players basically having to defer their professional careers and trying to find a place where they can go play. So the JUCOs are going to kill it.
Nice. Shout out to junior college. Good place for anyone trying to go to college. PK Steinberg writes in, last one for today, who are some current or recently retired baseball players you'd like to hear call a baseball game?
It's funny because we hired the one that I've been lobbying for years, and that'd be Chipper Jones. And whenever we get going, Chipper's going to be part of the broadcast. I've always thought Chipper would be great because he's so smart and he's so insightful. You know who else I'd like to hear on a baseball broadcast? Charles Barkley.
Oh, yeah.
Man, that would be a fun conversation that we had with him.
Yeah, that was great. I figure they could probably hook that up if they really wanted to. He works for TNT. They got postseason baseball. That would be a blast. He was a great interview today. We have another good one tomorrow, but we have something interesting going on with that. We have Todd on every Friday. Can you explain what we're going to be doing with Todd and talking, I guess, Candlestick a little bit and San Francisco stadiums as a whole?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the Giants ballparks, and Todd obviously brings his expertise. So I thought, you know what? No person better to talk about the ballparks in San Francisco, Candlestick, and then what is now known as Oracle Park, where the Giants play, than Dwayne Kuiper, the Giants announcer. He's going to join us with some great stories, including from a brawl that he was involved in. So we're going to be drawing on Kuiper's knowledge. That's it for today. I don't know. Do you want to throw in that last line?
Nah, go for it. Just close it up.
Okay. That's it for today. My thanks to Charles and to Kylie and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight. The podcast.